From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
The U.S. war against terrorism begins to spread, there's almost certainly more unrest about to appear throughout the region. So far from closing things down, U.S. power is likely, I think, to be stirring them up in ways that can't always be contained.
Palestinian-American scholar Edward Said on the cycle of violence. And as nuclear powers India and Pakistan move towards war, we'll hear from a Pakistani peace activist about the meaning of the escalation in the wake of the bombing of Afghanistan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Two Palestinians and an Israeli soldier died yesterday when Palestinians ambushed an Israeli patrol on the Jordanian border. The ambush followed a holiday weekend in which Israel arrested six Islamic militants on the West Bank, and the ceasefire ordered by Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat appeared to be crumbling. After Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon defied the Christian world by barring Arafat from attending midnight mass in Bethlehem on Christmas Eve, Arafat delivered a, quote, heavy-hearted speech on Palestinian television, which was relayed live to a subdued crowd in Manger Square, where a large banner read, Sharon assassinates the joy of Christmas. But barely 12 hours later, the leaders announced negotiations for a ceasefire would continue. After intense pressure from the U.S. and India, authorities in Pakistan yesterday said they arrested the founder of the Jaish-e-Mohammed organization, a militant Islamic group that Indian officials blame for a recent attack on the Indian Parliament building. The detention of Masood Azhar is the most significant step taken by Pakistan's military government to clamp down on those accused of staging the attacks to end Indian rule in Kashmir. Indian and Western intelligence agencies say Azhar has close links with the Taliban as well as Pakistan's intelligence service. Thousands of Pakistani troops have been clambering up the ragged border peaks of southwest of Islamabad for more than a week to seal off isolated escape routes out of Afghanistan. In Afghanistan's Tora Bora region, U.S. commandos and Afghan guerrillas still poke through the caves and bunkers where fighters from the Al-Qaeda organization made their last stand. But after 2.5 months of bombing and a manhunt aided by the world's most advanced intelligence-gathering devices, Osama bin Laden is still not in anybody's gun sights. Hundreds of asylum seekers stormed the tunnel between France and Britain yesterday, trying to force their way into England by walking the 25 miles through the Channel Tunnel. About 550 people took advantage of the quiet Christmas period to try to take over the tunnel, but none made it through. French police arrested 129 people in the first wave of refugees. At midnight, a second wave of some 400 was pushed back by French riot police using tear gas outside the Calais entrance to the tunnel. Refugees regularly try to enter Britain illegally from France on ferries, by train, or through the Channel Tunnel. In the last year, thousands of refugees have made that trip. This news from Moscow. A Russian military journalist who exposed nuclear waste dumping by the Russian Navy was convicted yesterday of treason and sentenced to 4 years in prison on a case that critics said illustrates the risks of antagonizing the Russian military. The ruling capped 4 years of legal twists and turns for Grigory Pasko, a 39-year-old Navy captain from Vladivostok, who reported on environmental abuses by the Russian Pacific Fleet. Although the judge threw out 9 counts of treason against Pasko, he was found guilty of collecting information on secret military exercises with the intention of passing it on to Japanese journalists. Zimbabwe's main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, accused the government of intensifying intimidation, blaming it for deaths of 3 of its members over the last 4 days. The MDC's leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, said he believed the deaths marked the beginning of a new campaign of violence and intimidation against the MDC in the run-up to the presidential election in March. Meanwhile, the government has accused the opposition of mounting terrorist attacks against its supporters. The man who authorities say hid explosives in his shoes and tried to ignite them during a transatlantic flight on Saturday has been placed under a suicide watch pending a psychological examination. Authorities said they were still trying to determine a motive for his actions and have not yet ruled out possible links to Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. While his identity remains unconfirmed, his passport bears the name John C. Reed. British authorities believe the passport is valid. Meanwhile, the Times of London reported today that Reed attended the same London mosque as Zacharias Massaoui, the Frenchman charged with conspiracy in connection with the September 11th attacks. And a report yesterday in France's La Provence newspaper, citing police and intelligence sources, said Reed had belonged to an Islamic movement called Tablighi, but left because he said it was not radical enough for him. A bond hearing is scheduled for Friday. If convicted of intimidation or assault of a flight crew, Reed could be sentenced to 20 years in prison. According to a senior official at the Internal Revenue Service, illegal tax shelters saved big companies at least $14.7 billion in federal income taxes last year. Now all companies are being offered an amnesty in return for confessing their illegal tax avoidance. The 95 companies that have already confessed their tax avoidance strategies to the IRS this year short-shrifted the government an amount equal to a dollar a week for every man, woman, and child in the United States. In a break from past practice, Langdon announced on Friday that companies that disclosed dubious tax shelters and the promoters who sold them by April 23rd would not be charged the usual 20% penalty on taxes that were improperly avoided. "This is our Christmas present to big companies," he said. "We're going to determine who's naughty and who's nice by waiving the 20% penalty for those who are nice to the IRS." And in a victory for the energy industry, the Bush administration's expected to announce soon that it is weakening a key clause of the 1970 Clean Air Act. The clause, which is known as the New Source Review, requires all power plants built before 1970 to install up-to-date pollution controls as soon as they undergo renovation. If eased, coal-burning power plants will be allowed to bypass tough anti-pollution rules, and neither elected officials nor environmentalists will be able to bring them to court. President Bush has been looking to weaken the Clean Air Act for some time, claiming its rules stifle energy output and do little to protect the environment. But it's only now that his approval ratings are soaring in the wake of the so-called war on terrorism that he's moved to revisit the issue. The utility industry was one of Bush campaign's staunchest supporters in the 2000 election. Edwin Starr, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodwin. Before we turn to Edward Said talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we've just made contact with a TV journalist crew that is on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. They are the founder of DCTV, where we're based at the firehouse just blocks from the first Ground Zero, Afghanistan being the second, John Alpert, his daughter Tommy Alpert, as well as Masuda Sultan, who is an Afghan woman, who they are traveling with to trace her roots back in Afghanistan. Tommy Alpert now joins us on the phone. I understand it's not a great one, but we thought it was worth the risk. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Tommy.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Where are you right now?
Right now we're on the road. We're driving back. We were just in Chemin, which is a border town, and we're headed back to Quetta. We were there in Chemin visiting a refugee area, and Masuda's organization purchased a bunch of supplies that we were distributing through the UN to the refugees.
And what is the situation like in the refugee camp?
Sorry, can you hear you?
What is the situation like in the refugee camp?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't spend too long at the camp. We're returning again tomorrow. The UN has actually provided them with tents and with food. And when we asked them what else they really needed, they said the largest thing we could provide for them is peace. And that's the same thing that all of the refugees that we spoke with echoed.
We're going to be following you on your trip into Afghanistan every day, speaking to one of you on the crew, as well as Masuda Sultan. But today, can you lay out why you are there? What is your plan for this 2 weeks?
Well, we are following Masuda. We followed her from New York City. She is an Afghan who has lived in New York ever since she was 5 years old. And I'm actually going to put her on the phone with you right now so that you can speak with her. And tomorrow is our first day that we're actually going into Afghanistan. So here she is. Hold on, please.
We're talking with Masuda
Sultan.
Good evening
and good morning to you.
It's good to have you with us. So what has your experience been like so far? When was the last time you were in Afghanistan?
I'm sorry, it's difficult to hear. Can you repeat, please?
When were you last in Afghanistan?
The last time I was in Afghanistan was in August. I went back to visit my family. I had left at the age of 5 and hadn't seen them.
So can you tell us about your trip to the refugee camp and what your organization is, what you were giving out?
We wanted to see what the situation was like for the new influx of refugees as a result of the U.S. bombing, and we went to a camp just here in Chemin, as you heard before. It was run by UNHCR, and we found out that they were providing them with tents and food, etc. We wanted to assess the situation, see what was needed. My organization brought them some rice and some sugar, and we found out that these people are doing okay, although by the looks of it, it seems like they're just barely surviving.
You're going to be traveling to Kandahar, where you come from. What are your thoughts right now? Do you feel anxiety after the very serious bombing of your city?
I absolutely feel anxiety. I'm worried at what I may find there. Just after I got off the phone with you and we arrived back in Quetta, I'm going to visit some family that was directly affected by the bombing. They lost about 19 members as part of my mother's cousin's family. And I'm very worried about what I'm going to find there and the looks on their faces. And I don't know what I'm going to find at Kandahar. A lot of my family has left, and I'd be curious to see what has happened to our old house, which was completely intact in August.
What was it like for you to meet the Afghan refugees, people from your own country? You can speak to them directly, and you are also a U.S. citizen, and it's because of the bombs of the United States that they've been driven out.
Yes, in many ways, I could understand. I felt like I was in the same boat with these Afghans because we really have little control over what these large powers do. Although, as an American, I think I have more of a capability to affect change in terms of lobbying the government, etc., than they do. These people are really helpless, and they're just victims of what's going on. It hurt me a lot to see that the people that came from the very same town that I grew up, that I was born in and that my parents grew up in, were suffering like this. I felt some sort of responsibility for this, yet I could not convey that to them.
I understand that Pakistan is not giving Afghans political refugee status, often forcing them to go back into Afghanistan, although they say they're doing so voluntarily.
I'm sorry, I heard the part about Pakistan not granting refugee status to some of these people. And I will address that by saying that Pakistan, it's very obvious that Pakistan doesn't have the capability to deal with these people. And a lot of them are being forced behind the border to stay in Afghanistan. We have not visited the camps or the people on the other side of the border just over in Afghanistan, but we hear the situation is very grave there. UNHCR does not currently have a presence in Afghanistan, and the people living just on the other side of the border are not getting the aid that they need.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Masuda Sultan, and we will continue with your Afghan journey tomorrow as you make your way into Afghanistan.
Thank you, and we'll report into you what we find on the other side of the border and in Kandahar.
Good luck and be
safe.
We'll speak to you in 24 hours. Thank you. That report from Masuda Sultan and Tommy Alpert on the border, the Pakistan side of the Afghan Pakistan border, as they make their way into Afghanistan, the crew with DCTV, where we are based, Downtown Community Television, led by John Alpert, the founder of Downtown Community Television. And we will continue with the Afghan journey each day that they are there. So do stay tuned as they make their way from the first ground zero here in New York to the second in Afghanistan. And now we turn to Zia Mien, who is a Pakistani-American scientist and anti-nuclear activist. You heard the latest news in the headlines, if you were tuned in them, about the latest tensions between India and Pakistan. And as India and Pakistan continue moving troops along their border in the largest military buildup in more than a decade, the leaders of the two nuclear rivals said yesterday they did not want a confrontation and blamed each other for the rising antagonism. The sentiment has been aired by presidents of both countries. The background on the situation in Pakistan, India. For more than 50 years, the two countries have been at bitter odds over several disputed territories along their common border. By far the most intractable, however, has been the dispute over Kashmir. The countries have fought two wars over the region, first in 47-48, then in 65, and ongoing skirmishes along the ceasefire line have left thousands dead each year. In the summer of 99, the two nuclear powers came to the brink of another war after Pakistani-backed forces infiltrated Indian-controlled Kashmir. A bitter two-month conflict ensued, ending only when Pakistani forces withdrew. Since then, the region has been relatively quiet, but this past October, the worst fighting in more than a year broke out as India started shelling what it called Pakistani military positions. The situation has only devolved from there, with alleged Pakistani militants attacking the Indian parliament just 2 weeks ago. Now, in the latest development, India has recalled its ambassador to Pakistan, hinting strongly that war is imminent. We turn now to a speech given recently by Pakistani peace activist Zia Mien, who examines the escalation of the India-Pakistan tensions within the context of the U.S. so-called war on terrorism. The speech was delivered at a conference sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee. Zia Mien is a Pakistani peace activist and lecturer at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University.
Oh. Is very briefly talk about some of the events that have started to unfold. My point of departure will be an old saying that some will remember, that war is the midwife of history. And this war and this administration and governments around the world have proceeded to accelerate and help the delivery of a child that has been long in the gestation. What we're seeing, in my opinion at least, is we have rewound the clock back to the beginnings of the Cold War, before the Soviet Union became a power able to counter that of the United States. So we're back to the late 1940s and the early 1950s. And there were all kinds of things that happened then. And I think it pays all of us to follow Noam's advice and go read some history books from that period as to just what was going on when you saw the effectively unchecked exercise of US power in terms of destabilizing governments, undermining social progressive movements, and starting to shape the world into not its own image, but into an image that suited certain interests in the United States. Now, what I want to say is that what we saw in the early 1950s and what we're seeing again now very clearly is that as an empire establishes itself, it offers people and governments very few choices. And many governments in the 1950s and many governments now are seeing that there are advantages to inciting empire, to take advantage of an empire to serve their own narrow domestic political and economic interests. And nowhere has that been more clear than in South Asia, where after September the 11th, the government of India rushed to the United States and said, you can use Indian military bases, you can use Indian ports, you can use Indian airstrips. We will help you all the way in this war against terrorism. Why, after 50 years of non-alignment and Indian notions of independence in the world and presenting itself as a counter to the notion of unchecked power, the government of India should rush to this kind of new position, I think bears scrutiny. And what it was that if the US had gone with India, as India tried to get them to do, it would have marginalized Pakistan. It would have consolidated India's role in the region. It would have given India the example and the opportunity to pursue its own narrow national interests, because the US would have become the godfather to India. Pakistan, seeing this, rushed to the US and said, oh, but look, we trained the Taliban. We know where Osama is. You should use us. And why Pakistan should have dumped the Taliban, who they worked so assiduously to create, right, was precisely the fact that they saw an even greater threat looming on the horizon. They could afford to lose Afghanistan if they could get back into the good books of the United States. So we're seeing a competition for who can be closest to the United States among ruling governments and elites around all these countries. The dilemma that we face, not just in South Asia, but around the world, is that as governments rush to cultivate the United States, as they rush to create their own lobbies, as they rush to present themselves in a whole series of ways as loyal allies in the war against terrorism, as they rush to present themselves as potentially open markets, as sources of cheap labor, as guarantors of all kinds of stability, is what happens to people in all this?
Zia Amin, a lecturer at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, Pakistani-American scientist. We'll have more on that speech in the second hour of the War and Peace Report. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. Back in a minute with Professor Edward Said.
Through the
Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Just as the Afghanistan new provisional government was preparing to take power last week, offering a possible end to decades of violence, President Bush announced that 2002 would still be a war year for the United States. Echoing a statement he made at the beginning of the campaign against al-Qaeda, the president warned that the so-called war on terrorism had only just begun and was likely to spread to other corners of the globe. While Bush has not yet confirmed any targets, he's hinted, along with his advisors, that Somalia, Yemen, or Iraq could be next. We turn now to Professor Edward Said, talking about the conflict in the Middle East. He's a professor of comparative literature at Columbia University, was born in Jerusalem in 1935 before partition, and has been an eloquent voice for justice throughout the Palestinian struggle. Professor Edward Said.
In any case, I'd like to speak about the general situation in which we find ourselves after September the 11th, and then I want to focus specifically on the Middle East. As somebody from West Asia, I'm pleased to be addressing a forum organized by South Asians, and since I don't believe in artificial divisions of that sort, nevertheless, perhaps geographical identifications are not useless all the times. But as a child of war myself, having been born into a war contest, being an adolescent in one, and then maturing in others, I've always felt that wars are never a solution. They seem to often beget other wars, as was the case with World War II, which produced colonial wars elsewhere, and certainly in my part of the world, we've had our share of those, plus, of course, civil wars, insurgencies, and so on. So I think the general situation of belligerency, can you hear me well or not? No, sorry about that. Yeah. Yes, louder. Is this better?
Yeah.
Right. I was simply saying that wars have always, you know, seemed to me to produce other wars, and they really are deeply unsatisfactory solutions to problems that and issues that arise and seem inevitably to lead to war, such as September the 11th. I don't think this is an exception, the war that we're in now and other wars that we may be heading towards. A few days ago, I received a letter from an admired friend of mine, a retired professor of history, who is certainly one of the greatest scholars produced in this country. In his letter, he wrote me the following: "In the current madness of our nation and the world, it seems determined to conquer. It seems to me that never in the many political crises that I've experienced, beginning with the Wallace campaign, have I felt so pessimistic about the country and so impotent. There seems to be no stirring of a movement, no social and cultural base from which an opposition could grow. The way in which Sharon is imitating Bush to eliminate the Palestinian government and consolidate Israeli domination, with nothing but anti-colonial men of desperation left to express the aspirations of the Palestinians, it is too horrendous. I wait for the U.S. to invade Iraq next." Now, these are certainly sentiments that I share in many ways, and that many of us who are Americans from the Islamic and Arab world also share. There's no point here in stressing what everybody in the world has already stressed endless times, that the dreadful September 11th terrorist attacks have had a profound effect not only on the city where we all live, and which so many of us have found to be a refuge from an old world of war and misery, as well as a superb place to work and study and teach and bring up children, but also it's had terrible effects on the world, not at all in finally salutary ways. There's no need at all now for me to try to compete patriotically with all the uncounted zillions of words that have been uttered or written expressing shock, outrage, anger, sorrow at the events of September the 11th. But there is a need, I think, to go beyond and think reflectively and critically, something which, alas, the present environment hasn't been so hospitable to. As a nation, we risk, I think, entering into an anti-democratic triumphalist phase, and this, which is huge power unopposed or unchallenged on grounds of fear or of angering the majority or of seeming unpatriotic, this would be a national and moral catastrophe of great proportions. We need always to be asking ourselves what events mean, what they represent, and who and what any particular speaker represents, who and what constituency, and for what purpose and interest they speak for. That is the type of debate which is the real health of democracy to which we must all remain committed. Now, as a deeply secular intellectual who has always suspected and made clear my disagreement and discomfort with religious politics, I find that the current war, not just against terrorism, which must always be critically analyzed and distinguished into types and kinds, but against what has been characterized vaguely as a kind of metaphysical evil, has been an extremely problematic one. First of all, because as Americans we have taken on the role of righteous avengers, which with the enormous military and political and economic power wielded by the U.S. has made for scenes of awful destruction and unforeseen circumstances all over the world, as well, of course, as creating vast new abstractions both to be for and to be against. Islam and the West, or America, I've said repeatedly, are generalizations I find difficult to follow blindly. I'm not one of the people, though, who ever had any time for Islamists or fundamentalists or the religious right anywhere that they have fought. They have brought nothing but deception, disappointment, tragedy, and waste wherever they've preached their gospel of indiscriminate war, in the case of the Islamists against the Kuffar. And I have no regret in seeing the demise of the Taliban regime and the Al-Qaeda. But I think it's incumbent on us to have equally critical assessments of all so-called faith-based politics, whether in the Muslim world or elsewhere. Bombing abortion clinics and preventing the teaching of evolution on religious grounds are as reprehensible here as imprisoning or abusing women at home there. And for that matter, discriminating against non-majority religions in places whether like Saudi Arabia or Israel, where I think such practices have to be opposed. The trouble with the present time, though, is that majority opinion seems to be represented not only by the government, which in its search for unity must appear to speak with one voice, I suppose, but also all or most of the other voices, those of the media in particular. I have found that this idea of unity, the political image that the government and the media, which has acted mostly without independence from the government, is what is being projected now. There really is a feeling being manufactured by the media and the government that a collective we exists and that we all act and feel together, as witnessed perhaps by such unimportant surface phenomena as flag flying and the use of the collective we by journalists in describing events all over the world in which the U.S. is involved. We bombed, we said, we decided, we acted, we feel, we believe, etc., etc. Of course, this is only marginally to do with the reality, which is far more complicated and far less reassuring. There's plenty of unrecorded or unregistered uncertainty and skepticism, I think, lots of questioning, even outspoken dissent here and there, but it seems hidden by overt patriotism. So American unity is being projected with such force as to allow very little questioning of U.S. policy, which in many ways is heading towards a series of more complex events after Afghanistan, the meaning of which many people will not realize until far too late. In the meantime, American unity needs to state to the world that what America does and has done cannot brook serious disagreement or discussion. Just like bin Laden, Bush tells the world, you are either with us or you are with terrorism and hence against us. So on the one hand, America is not at war with Islam, but only with terrorism. And on the other hand, in complete contradiction with that, since only America decides who or what Islam and terrorism are, we are against Muslim terrorism and Islamic rage as we define them. I've been astonished at how much cant and zeal and phony expertise there has been on the media, with a few exceptions. I mean, I've never seen a situation quite like this one. Leaving aside all the military expert, or as The Economist has called them, all the justly retired military analysts, the experts on Islam, people like the ever so arrogant and vulgar Thomas Friedman with his dreadful letters. I'm going to come back to him in a minute. As well as the ponderously vindictive and shallow Fuad Ajami and Daniel Pipes and the extraordinarily falsehood-mongering Bernard Lewis. I wish I had time to go over some of the stuff he says in that article he did a couple of months ago in The New Yorker, which I don't read anymore. All of them have been unanimous in their shallow generalizations, their gratuitous, uncritical repetition of cliches, their unhelpful and uninformed denunciations of a world that they have willfully turned into essentially a satellite of Osama bin Laden's crazed mind. There are, we need to remind ourselves, there are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. There are many, many languages, many traditions, many peoples, many histories, all of them claiming to be Muslim, but none of them is collapsible into things like rage or militancy or extremism. Then there's the, to go back to Friedman for a second, and I don't really want to waste too much time on him, but I mean, he keeps repeating this ridiculous thing about how Islam needs a reformation. Well, how many reformations were there? There was one. Spain never had a reformation. Why doesn't Spain get preached at for having produced the ETA terrorists?
You're listening to Professor Edward Said, professor of comparative literature at Columbia University, and we'll be back with his speech in just a minute here on the War and Peace Report, and you can go to our website as well to find out more information at democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Mao Zedong said, A3, here on the War and Peace Report, as we return to a speech by Professor Edward Said, professor of comparative literature at Columbia University, author of numerous books, articles, and essays, a voice for justice throughout the Palestinian struggle. Professor Said.
Turn now from the general situation to one specific situation, namely the Middle East, which during the course of the war against terrorism since September the 11th, both the U.S. government in the persons of the President and Colin Powell, Secretary of State, and the British government in the person of persons, rather, of Blair and Jack Straw, the foreign minister, have made specific reference to the need for a Palestinian state. In the meantime, as something important, you know, to keep the coalition together. In the meantime, the situation on the ground, partly as a result of September the 11th, but, you know, going back in time way before it, has gotten worse. And what I'd like now to spend the rest of the time doing is talking about the situation in Palestine as a quite different situation from that of Afghanistan. I wanted to remind you that there is a wonderful poem written in 1982, which by the leading Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. It's a poem that begins, "The world," and he wrote it, I should mention, in September of 1982. "The world is closing in on us, pushing us through the last passage, and we tear off our limbs to pass through." Then he says, "Where shall we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky?" I use that line, "after the last sky," as the title of a book I wrote in 1986 with a photographer, Jean Moore. It's now 19 years later, it's 2001. The Palestinian situation is much the same as it was in 1982, although it's worse because it's happening in Palestine, not Lebanon. Once again, Ariel Sharon and his military have surrounded an overwhelmingly civilian population of Palestinians. This time, they're besieged and imprisoned inside the West Bank and Gaza, which was occupied by Israel since 1967, of which 28% of the West Bank and 60% of Gaza have been allowed Palestinians since the Oslo process. The rest of the land has been taken over by 400,000 Israeli settlers in 145 settlements, including those on Palestinian land around Jerusalem. Since the Intifada began last September, Palestinians have been shut up by the Israeli military in villages, towns, cities, and farms into no less than 220 discontinuous little ghettos, blockaded, imprisoned for 15 straight months, in addition to curfews inside the towns from time to time, often for weeks at a stretch. No one, young or old, sick or well, dying or pregnant, student or doctor, can move without going through hours at the barricades manned by rude and purposely humiliating Israeli military searches. At this moment, 200 Palestinians are unable to receive kidney dialysis just because the Israeli military won't allow them to go to medical centers because of security reasons. There must be thousands and thousands of young Israeli conscripts who are abusing an entire population like this for months on end, with only a few refusing this demeaning and sadistic service. And one question that comes to mind, have any of the legions of foreign media personnel who cover the conflict, which is about as one-sided as any in history, have any of them done a story about these brutalized young Israelis trained chiefly to punish Palestinian civilians collectively as the main part of their military duty in the name of the Jewish people on the land of Israel? Compare this, please, with the enormously well-covered sins of the fundamentalist Taliban. As the Islamic Conference foreign ministers emergency meeting opened on December the 10th in Qatar, Yasser Arafat was not allowed by Israel to leave his office in Ramallah. His speech was read by an aide. 15 miles away from Ramallah in Gaza, the airport and the two aging Palestinian helicopters were destroyed a week earlier by Israeli planes and bulldozers, with, this is very important, with no one and no force to check, much less prevent, the daily tank incursions by Israel, of which this particular feat of military daring was a part. Gaza Airport is the only airport, is the only rather port of entry directly into Palestinian territory, and the only civilian airport in the world destroyed wantonly since World War II. Periodically, Israeli F-16s, generously supplied by the United States, have bombed and strafed Guernica style, Palestinian towns and villages. These, by the way, jets were never used by South African apartheid to bomb the townships in South Africa under apartheid. They're used regularly by Israel against Palestinians in their towns and villages, during which, of course, vast amounts of property are destroyed and lost, many civilians and police officials killed. There is no Palestinian army or navy or air force, and certainly no air or any other kind of defense to protect the people, and all of this is done at will. Apache attack helicopters, again supplied by the U.S., have missile murdered 77 Palestinian leaders, allegedly for terrorist offenses, past or future, with a group of unknown Israeli intelligence operatives holding decision-making powers for these assassinations, presumably also approved by the cabinet and, of course, by the U.S., which has tacitly approved of the practice of self-defense. The helicopters have also done an efficient job of bombing Palestinian Authority installations, police as well as civilian. During the night of December 5th, the Israeli army entered the five-story offices of the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics in Ramallah, carried off the computers, every file and every report, then destroyed the building in an act of theft and vandalism designed to efface as many of the significant traces of collective Palestinian life as possible. In 1982, the same army under the same commander entered West Beirut, carted off documents and files from the Palestinian Research Center, then flattened the structure. A few days later came the massacres of Sabra and Shatila. The suicide bombers of Hamas and Islamic Jihad have, of course, been at work, as Sharon knew perfectly well that they would, since after a 10-day lull in the fighting in late November, Sharon suddenly ordered the murder of a Hamas leader, a man called Mustafa Abu Hannoud, an act designed quite consciously to provoke Hamas into retaliation and then enable his armies to resume their butchery of Palestinians. 8 barren years of discussions, of peace discussions, that brought Palestinians 50% unemployment, 70% rate of poverty, which means that people are living, 70% of the population is living on less than $2 a day per person, and a 60% increase in the number of settlements, and of course the endless suffering of basically unopposable house demolitions and the unspeakably cruel Israeli practice of destroying trees and orchards have left residents of the occupied territories with no real options. Yet Sharon has the gall to keep repeating, and this is why I want to speak about it this evening, he keeps repeating that Israel has suffered the same terrorism as that meted out by bin Laden in the United States, even as 5 or 6 Palestinians to 1 Israelis have been killed in the last few months alone, with over 30,000 direct Palestinian casualties. Under the liberal regime of Ehud Barak, there was a 60%, as I said a moment ago, a 60% increase in settlements, along with a dramatic expansion of the road system for Jewish drivers only. I mean, if you're non-Jewish, you cannot drive on these settlement roads. The Oslo process made movement nearly impossible for most Palestinians, and as for entry from the West Bank into Arab East Jerusalem, which was annexed by Israel, that too has been forbidden for the last several years. Palestinian universities, hospitals, clinics, and schools have regularly been closed with scarcely a note of it made by the Western media, which has been busy chronicling violence through lenses provided by the Israeli military. The crucial point in all this, and I really cannot insist on it more strongly, is that Israel has been in military occupation of Palestinian land since 1967. This is the longest such occupation in history, and the only occupation anywhere in the world today. This is the original and continuing violence against which all the Palestinian acts of violence have been directed. Yet there has never been any narrative of this occupation or of the enormous amount of Palestinian suffering in place before either the Israeli or the world public. And in this, I think the media plays an incredible part under, obviously, pressure from the Zionist lobby. I'll give you an example. Yesterday, in the Sunday New York Times and the Week in Review, there was a long article by James Bennett about how Israel is becoming like Lebanon. And throughout the entire article, which goes started on page one and continues for several columns on an inside five, you know, page five, there isn't a single mention of the fact that the violence on the West Bank is in occupied territory. So if you don't happen to know it, you just get the impression that Palestinians are just doing violence because they just hate Jews and they want to kill Israelis and so on and so forth. So the actual condition of military occupation is simply effaced from the narrative. And you don't get an impression at all that there is anything particularly wrong. It's just that, you know, Palestinians like to kill Israelis. On December the 10th, for instance, two children aged 3 and 13 were killed by Israeli bombs in Hebron. Yet at the same time, an EU delegation, along with the US, was demanding that Palestinians should curtail violence and terrorism. On December the 11th, five more Palestinians were killed, all of them civilians, the victims of helicopter bombings of Gaza's teeming refugee camps. To make matters worse, as a result of the September 11th bombing, the word terrorism is being used to blot out acts of resistance against military occupation, something Israel has been doing in its propaganda since the 1970s, to call everything that Palestinians do as resistance against military occupation, or call it all terrorism, and to make it impossible for there to be any causal or even narrative connection between the dreadful killing of civilians, which I've always opposed, and the terrible suffering of 35 years of collective punishment that gives rise, direct rise, to suicide bombings. What every Western pundit or official who pontificates, as they all do, about Palestinian terrorism needs to ask is how simply forgetting or overlooking the very existence of the military occupation is supposed to stop terrorism. Of course it can't. Doubtless because of frustration and poor advice, Arafat's great mistake was in trying to make a deal with the occupation, which was what I think the Oslo peace process was all about. And it was always about Israeli security. Not a word was ever said, because the Israelis are so powerful and the U.S. support them, that not a word was ever said about Palestinian security and the need for a Palestinian state. And indeed, that bizarre obsession with Israeli security to the exclusion of nearly everything else has become the valid international idiom through which General Zinni, the former Marine commander who has been in Palestine and Israel for the last couple of weeks and then has been recalled, and Javier Solana preach at the PLO while remaining totally silent about the occupation. It's absolutely grotesque. Since 1992, the Israeli mistake has been to imagine that by conning Arafat and his coterie into interminable discussions and tiny concessions, that they were going to get general Palestinian acceptance, which, like most of Israel's gambles over time, have proved to be failures. All official Israeli policies thus far have proved to be worse rather than better for Israel than before. Anyone can prove what I'm saying by simply asking the question, is Israel more secure and more accepted now than it was 10 years ago? And the answer has to be no. The terrible, and in my opinion, stupid Hamas suicide raids against civilians in Haifa and Jerusalem over the weekend of December 1 and 2 should be condemned, yes. But in order for these condemnations to make any sense, they must, in my opinion, be bracketed with the Israeli assassination of Abu Hanoud earlier in the week, along with the killing also early in the week of five Palestinian children by what has been admitted to be a deliberately planted Israeli booby trap in Gaza. To say nothing of the 20 houses destroyed, the miscellaneously killed Palestinians throughout Gaza and the West Bank villages, the constant tank incursions, and the endlessly detailed grinding down of Palestinian life, and the consequently blocked realization of Palestinian independence minute by minute for the past 35 years. In the end, desperation only produces poor results, none worse than that George W. and Colin Powell seem to have given Sharon a green light while he was in Washington on December the 2nd, just as Al Haig gave him a green light in May of 1982. The instructions seem to have been, you can do anything you like, because Bush is so obsessed with terrorism and he considers Palestinian terrorism. So he told Sharon, do anything you like, but don't kill Arafat. And with this support went the usual ringing declarations about ending the violence and fighting terrorism, so that the people under occupation for almost four decades and their hapless, inept leader were suddenly turned into worldwide aggressors, required to bring to justice their very own criminals, even as the Israeli army was systematically destroying the entire Palestinian police structure, which was supposed to do the arresting. I have no doubt that Sharon and his people are by now so habituated to their own fabrications that they actually believe they are not the poor bastards whose lives they've been making miserable since 1948 are the victims. In effect, then, Arafat is hemmed in on all sides, a perhaps ironic result of his appetite for being all things Palestinian to everyone, enemies and friends alike. This makes him both a tragically heroic and a kind of bumbling figure. No Palestinian today is going to disavow Arafat and his leadership, for the simple reason that despite all of his mistakes, he is being punished and humiliated because he is a Palestinian leader, and in that capacity, his mere existence offends people like Sharon and his American backers. I think Arafat's situation is largely a result of the occupation, and his mistakes have come from the occupation. But I think one has to look at the Sharonian view of the world, which has no place in it at all for Palestinians or for Arafat, whom he has been calling all sorts of terrible names for the past several years. Partly, I think, because Sharon has no ideas as such, and partly because of his immense bulk, he finds it therefore natural to do what he has always done, kill Palestinians, either by the bullet or by stifling them, the way a large pachyderm does to nasty little animals that happen to be there. Sharon has always held, this is very important, I think, also to understand, that Sharon has always held the notion that by dispensing with Arafat, he can then make a series of independent agreements with local warlords, rather the way the British in 19th century Africa...
Time. You've been listening to Professor Edward Said of Columbia University giving a speech on the Middle East conflict. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Lizzie Ratner, Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. We're still looking for end of the year holiday gifts. You can give your money to a nonprofit as opposed to the Pentagon. Go to democracynow.org. We are broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of The Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
What we're seeing, in my opinion at least, is we have rewound the clock back to the beginnings of the Cold War, before the Soviet Union became a power able to counter that of the United States. So we're back to the late 1940s and the early 1950s.
A Pakistani anti-nuclear scientist talks about the impact of the so-called war on terrorism on South Asia. As Arafat is banned from attending midnight mass in Bethlehem, a new leader rises from the street. We'll hear a rare interview with a Palestinian leader in hiding. But first, activist Charlotte Bunch setting the record straight on the lessons of the World Conference Against Racism. All that and more coming up. We'll be right back. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two Palestinians and an Israeli soldier died yesterday when Palestinians ambushed an Israeli patrol on the Jordanian border. The ambush followed a holiday weekend in which Israel arrested six Islamic militants on the West Bank, and the ceasefire ordered by Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat appeared to be crumbling. After Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon defied the Christian world by barring Arafat from attending midnight mass in Bethlehem on Christmas Eve, Arafat delivered a heavy-hearted speech on Palestinian television, which was relayed live to a subdued crowd in Manger Square, where a large banner read, "Sharon assassinates the joy of Christmas." But barely 12 hours later, the leaders announced that negotiations for a ceasefire would continue. Early this morning, Israeli troops entered the Palestinian-controlled village of Azun and arrested 17 people. Five of those arrested were Palestinian policemen. This according to the town mayor. After intense pressure from the U.S. and India, authorities in Pakistan yesterday said they arrested the founder of Jaish-e-Mohammed. The organization, a militant Islamic group that Indian officials blame for a recent attack on the Indian Parliament building. The detention of Masood Azhar is the most significant step taken by Pakistan's military government to clamp down on those accused of staging attacks to end Indian rule in Kashmir. Indian and Western intelligence agencies say Azhar has close links with the Taliban as well as with Pakistan's intelligence service. Tensions between the two nuclear-armed neighbors have escalated since an armed assault on the parliament left 14 people dead, including the attackers. Troops exchanged heavy fire today along the line of control, which partitions the Pakistani and Indian-controlled sectors. We'll have an analysis of the situation between India and Pakistan with Pakistani scientist Zia Amin in a moment. Thousands of Pakistani troops have been clambering up the ragged border peak southwest of Islamabad for more than a week to seal off isolated escape routes out of Afghanistan. In Afghanistan's Tora Bora region, U.S. commandos and Afghan guerrillas still poke through the caves and bunkers where fighters from the Al-Qaeda organization made their last stand. But after 2.5 months of bombing and a manhunt aided by the world's most advanced intelligence-gathering devices, Osama bin Laden is still not in anybody's gun sights. Interrogations of captured Al-Qaeda members in Pakistan and Afghanistan seem to have provided little as to who leads Al-Qaeda and who might still be on the run in Afghanistan or elsewhere. Pakistani soldiers and border guards have arrested about 300 Al-Qaeda members in that area over the last week and turned them over to Pakistani intelligence officers who are interrogating them intensely in cooperation with the CIA and FBI officers on the scene. So far, they have turned up no trace of bin Laden. On Afghanistan's first post-Taliban Christmas, tribal elders and warlords gathered in Kabul to stress that Afghanistan remains an Islamic state. Afghan elders in flowing beards and robes who came to Kabul for the inauguration of the new interim government a few days ago filled the ruined city. But on the day of peace in the war zone, British and U.S. soldiers could be seen eating a Christmas lunch in the center of Kabul. Strangely, shops were doing a roaring trade in Christmas trees. And for the first time since the Taliban came to power, the only Christian church in Afghanistan was not empty of worshipers on Christmas. And this news from Zimbabwe. The main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, known as MDC, accused the government of intensifying intimidation, blaming it for the deaths of three of its members over the last 4 days. The MDC's leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, said he believed the deaths marked the beginning of a new campaign of violence and intimidation against the MDC in the run-up to the presidential election in March. Meanwhile, the government has accused the opposition of mounting terrorist attacks. This news from Russia. A Russian military journalist who exposed nuclear waste dumping by the Russian Navy was convicted yesterday of treason and sentenced to 4 years in prison, a case that critics said illustrates the risks of antagonizing the military. Although the judge threw out 9 counts of treason against Grigory Pasko, he was found guilty of collecting information on secret military exercises with the intention of passing it on to Japanese journalists. And finally, the man who authorities say hid explosives in his shoes and tried to ignite them during a transatlantic flight this past weekend has been placed under a suicide watch pending a psychological exam. Authorities said they were still trying to determine a motive for his actions and have not ruled out possible links to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network, though they say they have no information for sure. While his identity remains unconfirmed, his passport bears the name John Reed. British authorities believe the passport is valid.
Oh, many times in my life I've been alone, left alone. Oh, I've broken down.
Love is a healer. Donna Summers here on the War and Peace Report. So we broadcast just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. So we read in the headlines, after intense pressure from the U.S. and India, authorities in Pakistan said they arrested the founder of a militant group that Indian officials blame for the recent attack on the Indian Parliament building, which led to the deaths of 14 people, including the attackers. Troops exchanged heavy fire today along the line of control, which partitions the Pakistani and Indian-controlled sectors. Despite the arrest, Indian officials say they've not ruled out mounting raids on militant camps across the border. The situation between India and Pakistan is intensifying as India and Pakistan continue moving troops along their border in the largest military buildup in more than a decade. For more than 50 years, India and Pakistan have been at bitter odds over several disputed territories along the common border. By far the most intractable has been Kashmir. The countries have fought two wars over the region. In the summer of 1999, the two nuclear powers came to the brink of another war over Kashmir. Since then, the region has been relatively quiet, but this past October, the worst fighting in more than a year broke out as India started shelling what it called Pakistani military positions. We're going to turn now to a speech given recently by Pakistani peace activist, anti-nuclear scientist Zia Amin, an event sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee. This is Dr. Zia Amin.
I'd like to start by saying that it's great to see everybody here. And I bring you greetings from the Princeton Peace Network, our small group in Princeton, founded after September the 11th to oppose the war and to find paths to peace, justice, and security for everybody that are based on common human values. And I think, for me at least, a sense that we need to reclaim a tradition that seems to have disappeared in the past decade as we've struggled with a whole series of other issues, which is that our enemy is war itself. And it's not a particular war or a particular cause of war, but the very social institutions and sensibilities that see war as an option. What I want to do briefly, since there is a workshop afterwards where I will talk in greater detail about, you know, what all this has meant in South Asia, where, you know, there are in excess of a billion people whose future has been transformed in some ways by the events of the last 3 months. But in some ways, not. And so we can talk in detail there about some of those questions. And I asked Joe for a TV and a VCR where I'd like to show a very short documentary film that we have just made. It's the first documentary film made in Pakistan on the nuclear threat and the relationship to Islamic fundamentalism and the example that the United States set to the world by saying that nuclear weapons offer a path to security. And we need to say that it wasn't a path to security here, and it's not going to be a path to security for us either in South Asia. So you're most welcome to come to that. What I want to do now is very briefly talk about some of the events that have started to unfold. My point of departure will be an old saying that some will remember, that war is the midwife of history. And this war and this administration and governments around the world have proceeded to accelerate and help the delivery of a child that has been long in the gestation. What we're seeing, in my opinion at least, is we have rewound the clock back to the beginnings of the Cold War, before the Soviet Union became a power able to counter that of the United States. So we're back to the late 1940s and the early 1950s. And there were all kinds of things that happened then. And I think it pays all of us to follow Noam's advice and go read some history books from that period as to just what was going on when you saw the effectively unchecked exercise of US power in terms of destabilizing governments, undermining social progressive movements, and starting to shape the world into not its own image, but into an image that suited certain interests in the United States. Now, what I want to say is that what we saw in the early 1950s and what we're seeing again now very clearly is that as an empire establishes itself, it offers people and governments very few choices. And many governments in the 1950s and many governments now are seeing that there are advantages to inciting empire, to take advantage of an empire to serve their own narrow domestic political and economic interests. And nowhere has that been more clear than in South Asia, where after September the 11th, the government of India rushed to the United States and said, you can use Indian military bases, you can use Indian ports, you can use Indian airstrips. We will help you all the way in this war against terrorism. Why, after 50 years of non-alignment and Indian notions of independence in the world and presenting itself as a counter to the notion of unchecked power, the government of India should rush to this kind of new position, I think bears scrutiny. And what it was that if the US had gone with India, as India tried to get them to do, it would have marginalized Pakistan. It would have consolidated India's role in the region. It would have given India the example and the opportunity to pursue its own narrow national interests, because the US would have become the godfather to India. Pakistan, seeing this, rushed to the US and said, oh, but look, we trained the Taliban. We know where Osama is. You should use us. And why Pakistan should have dumped the Taliban, who they worked so assiduously to create, right, was precisely the fact that they saw an even greater threat looming on the horizon. They could afford to lose Afghanistan if they could get back into the good books of the United States. So we're seeing a competition for who can be closest to the United States among ruling governments and elites around all these countries. The dilemma that we face, not just in South Asia, but around the world, is that as governments rush to cultivate the United States, as they rush to create their own lobbies, as they rush to present themselves in a whole series of ways as loyal allies in the war against terrorism, as they rush to present themselves as potentially open markets, as sources of cheap labor, as guarantors of all kinds of stability, is what happens to people in all this? Now, in the case of Pakistan and India, there are two specific dangers that we face. Those dangers are most clearly evident in a recent statement made by General Pervez Musharraf, Pakistan's military dictator, who, when George Bush was a candidate for president, when he was famously asked those questions about, you know, who is the, you know, dictator of Pakistan, he didn't know when he was asked. Well, now he knows. He's now, you know, George's best friend. General Musharraf, you know, has planted his flag securely next to the Stars and Stripes, and he recently went on television to explain in Pakistan to his people why Pakistan had supported the United States in this. And he said, look, we have secured four key national interests. The first is we have secured our sovereignty, which means that if we'd gone up against the United States, we would have been bombed too. Right? The way the New York Times reported this was that after September the 11th, the United States told Pakistan, as was pointed out, either you are with us or against us, and Pakistan was threatened, according to the Times, with everything short of war. So General Musharraf says, first, we have saved national sovereignty. The second, we have saved our economy. In other words, by virtue of being loyal, the Americans will send money. And for a bankrupt country, that's not a bad thing. The third thing he said is we have secured our nuclear weapons. And the fourth thing he said is we have secured our position on the Kashmir dispute. Right? So this is how narrow interests and larger interests merge in this crisis. Now, for everybody, certainly in this audience, you know, I don't need to go into great detail, but over the last 10 years, we've seen the combination of the nuclearization of South Asia, where both India and Pakistan have tested nuclear weapons, and they have fought yet another war over Kashmir. The drift has been that initially the US tried to restrict and restrain the development of nuclear weapons and tried to impose some kind of restraint on the tension over the Kashmir region. But even before September the 11th, the US was starting the process of bringing South Asia back in from the cold. So President Clinton made his famous visit, in which basically he said, you can keep your nuclear weapons, to India. It's a market of 1 billion people. And to Pakistan, he said, look, you have to behave. Pakistan is now showing that it knows how to behave. Now, in the middle of September the 11th and the war in Afghanistan, the Pakistanis have started to believe that this military government that we have has started to believe that they don't really need to take democracy very seriously because they've proved that they're allies. And so last week, General Musharraf announced that even though there are elections scheduled for next year, he will make himself president and stay as president for at least 5 years. Even though there are going to be elections and so what's the point? But and there was no comment from the United States. And the sanctions that were imposed on Pakistan after his coup in 1999 have been lifted. So he's got away with it. And he's going to get away with it again because he's proved his loyalty. In the same way with the nuclear weapons, the sanctions that were imposed on both Pakistan and India are being lifted. And India is actually now emerging as a potentially major US military ally in the region. There is talk now of US military sales to India, of joint military planning, and of joint military operations between the United States and India on counterterrorism, counterproliferation, and who knows what else. Now, what interest of India's is served by this? The answer is relatively straightforward, that the Indians feel that their role in the region has not been appropriately understood. They are the biggest power, and therefore they should dominate. In the same way that the US, being the biggest power, feels that it should dominate, but not South Asia, the whole world. So there is this kind of tier that is very clearly emerging, as we saw back in the 1950s, of not big fish eating little fish, but tiers of gangsterism, tiers of a willingness to exploit and use force, who are tied to each other by crude notions of loyalty and dependability. Where does that leave us? Where it leaves us, I think, is that if we go back to where I said this all started, when Pakistan and India were founded, they went to war over Kashmir. And after that, the first thing the Pakistanis did was to go to the US and ask for $4 billion of military aid, which didn't come. But as the Cold War started to develop, it did come. And for 10 years, Pakistan had a military dictator supported by the US, financed by the US, given political legitimacy by the United States. And he got us into a war with India over Kashmir. In the 1980s, we had another military dictator, and we had the last great battle of the Cold War in Afghanistan, which everybody's read about, where again, the US gave military support, the US gave money, the US gave political legitimacy, and what happened? We ended up in another war. Now we're in a third version of this, where we have a military dictator, the US is giving money, the US will give guns. And we will probably have yet another war. And this time, we have nuclear weapons. But in one sense, you see, it doesn't seem to matter because those weapons don't have global reach. It's okay for the tribes to kill each other. And this is where, when you rewind back to President Bush's statement about the war on terrorism, he said this is about terrorism with global reach. Touch us and we will kill you. Your own wars, well, you know, going back to Julius Caesar, the tribes are supposed to be restless. That's proof that they're not civilized. Now, the dilemma, of course, is that we're talking about 1 billion people and the prospect of nuclear war. And the US basically saying we can live with this. What we face is an unprecedented historical moment, as Noam Chomsky pointed out, that the pattern and process of domination has reached a new standard and a qualitatively new stage. What has not happened is that the arts of resistance have not evolved in a way to counter this. Now, while there are these new global social movements about environmentalism, about human rights, about globalization, and you know, et cetera, they lack that genuine internationalist, globalized depth that we need of activism beyond borders. Right? Noam Chomsky was recently in India and Pakistan, and I came back with him last week from Pakistan. What we need to do is to find ways where the pattern and the recognition of what you could call rightful resistance needs to be established. That people here need to know that there are peace groups and activists on the ground in all these countries.
Zia Mian, Pakistani-American anti-nuclear scientist, teaches at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to go to the West Bank, to an undisclosed location, where in the last few months, the last few weeks, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Raphael Kraft interviewed a man who is being talked about as a possible successor to Yasser Arafat. He is in hiding. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. Back in a minute.
And in my opinion, the young generation of white, black, brown, whatever else there is, you're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution, a time when there's got to be a change. People in power have misused it, and now there has to be a change, and a better world has to be built, and the only way it's going to be built is with extreme methods. And I, for one, will join in with anyone, don't care what color you are, as long as you want to change this miserable condition that exists on this earth. Thank you.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice.
I'm living in L.A. Only shooting up brothers carrying buckets in their grips. Only to be free because of lack of evidence. No, that was in Chicago. Let me tell you about the bird.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report, Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. You were just listening to No Justice, No Peace from One World Tribe here on Democracy Now in Exile. Well, it's been almost 4 months to the day since the World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance was launched in Durban, South Africa. For 11 days, from the end of August through the beginning of September, the news wires crackled with the controversies of the conference, although not a lot of U.S. media covered it much. The dispute over reparations for slavery, the uproar over language equating Zionism with racism, and of course, ultimately, the U.S. delegations pulling out of the conference. But then just days after it all ended, and a true discussion might have begun, two planes crashed into the World Trade Center. A third drove into the Pentagon, and the news wires that had been broadcasting from Durban went dead. The controversies, as well as the gains and many lessons, were largely forgotten. But as feminist scholar and longtime activist Charlotte Bunch insisted at a gathering of the Durban Women's Group in early December, the lessons of the context of the U.S. so-called war on terrorism, the speech was delivered at a conference sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee. We're going to go to that speech, and then when we come back from our break, we'll hear an interview with Margan Barghouti, the Secretary General of Fatah and a central figure in the Second Intifada. Right now, feminist scholar Charlotte Bunch.
As several people have said, looking at the U.S. media coverage, you would have the impression that the World Conference Against Racism was actually about the Middle East. And so we wanted to start with what it was really about from our point of view, setting the record straight, is all the variety of issues that you have just heard. And I think it is instructive, however, to talk about how the U.S. government behaved at the World Conference Against Racism and the way in which it used the Middle East conflict to cover up its behavior. And in particular, I think the obsession of the U.S. and its behavior at this conference is particularly instructive after 9/11. And many of us who were either still in Durban or, as Catherine Powell said, just arrived back the minute it happened, there was some way in which, of course, we were all shocked by the horrible events. But in some way, I think we were less shocked because of what we had seen at the World Conference and the way the U.S. behaved and our own repulsion with our own government in the Durban process. The Bush administration attitude toward the World Conference Against Racism was essentially, do it our way or we'll go home. That was basically its position, and I think it was a forerunner to what we now see post 9/11, which is essentially, you're either with us or you're against us. There is a consistency in the way the government behaved in Durban and what we're dealing with today. And that's consistency I want to speak to because I think we need to be clear that the Bush administration played havoc with the World Conference Against Racism even before we got to Durban. In the entire preparatory process at the Commission on Human Rights in March, April, when the U.S. got bumped off of the commission because even our allies were so disgusted by the government attitude toward the business of that commission meeting, and also in the preparatory process, there was a constant threat to go home as if that would somehow make everybody go along with the U.S. And that was, I think, one of the most profoundly disrespectful attitudes that the U.S. government has exhibited, disdainful of the months and months of government and NGO preparation for the conference of the hundreds and thousands of people who saw this as an important political arena, and the way in which the Bush administration treated all of us is indicative, I think, of the problem we're up against. Now, I do want to say that I think that the Bush administration used the issues of the Middle East to avoid the issues of the conference. As Gwen said, they didn't want it to happen in the first place. And so they used a real conflict in the world. And let's remember that at the moment of Durban, this conflict in the Middle East was at a very volatile point. And it is one of the main conflicts in our world that the UN and the world powers have not solved for 50 years. So what burden was put on the World Conference Against Racism that it was supposed to deal with all the other problems of racism in the world and their multiple manifestations that you've heard some of tonight, and at the same time solve this problem? I mean, it was an absurd starting point to think that this conference should bear the weight of somehow solving something that the UN has not solved in these past 50 years. I also think we have to distinguish between a variety of things that were happening, and in particular between a legitimate critique of Israel or any other government as a government and issues of anti-Semitism. And what we saw the Bush administration doing was conflating any critique of the Israeli government and calling it anti-Semitism. And that did not serve the cause either of anti-Semitism or of any interest in resolving the conflict in the Middle East. And I don't say that there was no anti-Semitism in Durban. We live in a racist world. There were manifestations of all kinds of racism, even within Durban, of white racism, of anti-Semitism, of many kinds of racism. So it's not to say that there was no anti-Semitism ever present, but to be really clear about the way the U.S. government used that issue to avoid dealing with racism, to avoid dealing in particular with the issues of the U.S. government responsibility for slavery, for colonialism, for reparations, et cetera. So I think in the face of 9/11, it's really important to start by understanding how the U.S. government has positioned itself in the world before that and how that connects to what we're dealing with afterwards. Now, I think that if we start from that disdainful behavior in the global arena that has characterized particularly the last year, but also the last few decades of the refusal of the U.S. to pay its dues, the refusal of the U.S. to sign and ratify most of the human rights treaties, et cetera, kind of came to a peak in Durban in the sense of the way in which they really didn't care about that conference. And we need to remember that was not the only alternative that the U.S. government had, that there are other alternatives to walking out when you don't get your way, just as there are other alternatives to bombing. There are alternatives when a country, we've all worked in the UN arena, disagrees with other countries about the document. First of all, you work for your position. You try to convince people. Secondly, you compromise. Third, if necessary, you take reservations. But the U.S. couldn't be bothered with going through those processes because it was essentially not interested in this conference having anything successful happen. And so it was playing its cards to make sure that there was no real product of the conference that they were committed to having to endorse. So the action of walking out before it was even over, before you even knew what the final language was going to be, was, I think, indicative of an attitude of not wanting the conference to succeed first, and secondly, being unwilling to be bound by anything the conference said afterwards. So making sure that that the U.S. government was not there. Now, I say all of this because I think that, unfortunately, much of this discussion that we all came back from Durban ready to have, of course, has been shunted aside by the horrible events of 9/11. But I think that they are connected. I think they are linked. And I think that if we look at how the U.S. government behaved in Durban, it might help us to deal a little bit with how we're behaving now. And I think that the best phrase I can think of is the one that William Fulbright coined in Vietnam, which is the arrogance of power. the arrogance of power epitomized the U.S. behavior in Durban toward other people. I think that many of us hoped that the 9/11 tragedies would lead to an opportunity in this country for some reexamination of the U.S. position in the world. I think we hoped, we held our breath. I was in South Africa for a week hearing conversations that made me hope that the U.S. would begin to reexamine its foreign policy, to think about its place in the world. But unfortunately, as we all know, that has not been the response of the U.S. government. And instead, we have seen the U.S. government once more flaunting multilateralism, but this time in the name of a coalition that it is coercing and leading rather than allowing real multilateral responses. I think we had an opportunity, we had a moment when there was sympathy for people in the United States, unlike anything I've experienced in my whole lifetime. I was in Durban, the sympathy was overwhelming of people. Everyone, even the hardest critics of our government, were sympathetic about what had happened. But we are losing that opportunity by the kind of behavior of our government at this time. And I think the refusal of the Bush administration to even take seriously the other alternatives to war, to even explore the other alternatives to justice, to explore international tribunals for terrorism that Mary Robinson called for when she talked about crimes against humanity on September 11th. The refusal of the government, the most unbelievable refusal of the U.S. government in face of all of these events to continue to oppose international agreements, to continue to have congressional resolutions against the International Criminal Court, to be prepared to say we'll send troops to the Netherlands, a friendly country, before we will allow any American to be brought before the International Criminal Court. The refusal last week in Geneva to sign on to germ warfare inspections in the face of all the fears in this country of germ warfare, and yet we are the government, that government that says it represents us, is the one refusing when 143 other countries say we must do this. Okay, 30 seconds, it's impossible. All right. Anyway, to bring this to a close, I think that what we saw in Durban was a kind of ridicule strategy, an attempt to ridicule the conference in many ways by the U.S. And I think we now see a lot of manipulation, but the context is still there. We must remember that we are in a several decades long campaign of right-wing forces in the United States to make sure that the United Nations is not effective or is destroyed. And I think that Durban was a part of that. We are in the midst of a campaign now, I think, with Bush's military tribunals that will undermine the last remnants of hope for an international human rights system if allowed to go forward, because we will have no voice left in the United States, which has already been hypocritical, but we will have no voice left to speak out against military tribunals in the rest of the world if they proceed in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So I just want to say that it seems to me that the spirit of Durban that Anita sort of called us to in the beginning, the spirit of Durban of dialogue among civilizations, of dialogue about what it is that we have all suffered and what we have learned and how we could build another world, is being further eroded every day by our current government policies. So it seems to me that it's really urgent that we develop truly multilateral alternatives to the current war that our government is engaged in. I've been a part of a group that had developed something called the 12 Points to Stop the War and Support Women's Human Rights, which we had on the table outside. Some people in the New York Say No to War group have recently written a document, which I have here for those who want it, calling on the Democratic leadership in Washington to become a leadership and to actually become an opposition, to call for some bipartisan dialogue. There are many different efforts you all know about. But I want to link it in kind of closing to that attitude we saw in Durban was the exact opposite of what Anita talked about. What we saw from the U.S. government in Durban was the exact opposite of what Anita talked about at the dialogue of the NGOs about how we could begin to change the world we live in. And I think the racially coded term of so-called defending civilization that the Bush administration has been using is really at the heart of the issues that we were facing in Durban and the issues that we face following 9/11. Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlotte Bunch, Executive Director of the Center for Women's Global Leadership at Douglas College, Rutgers University in New Jersey. When we come back, we go to the West Bank to an interview done with a Palestinian leader in hiding. Stay with us.
Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. But there will be no peace till man get equal rights and justice. Hey, equal rights and justice. Justice, ain't equal rights and justice. Everybody wants to go up to heaven. None of them, nobody wants to die.
Equal rights, Anthony B., not to be confused with our own Anthony S., here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the controversy over Israel's refusal to allow Yasser Arafat to make his annual pilgrimage to Bethlehem continues to simmer, the Palestinian leader can look to some sympathy from home, but not much. Just this weekend, Palestinian unity came close to dissolving as clashes between Yasser Arafat's police and Palestinian civilians left six dead, dozens injured. The violence was sparked by Arafat's attempt to satisfy Israeli and U.S. demands that he clamp down on organizations that advocate terrorism. It was the worst case of Palestinian-on-Palestinian violence since 1994, and it sparked fears of civil war. Meanwhile, as Arafat's legitimacy continues to falter, the popularity of Marwan Barghouti, another Fatah veteran, continues to rise. Known as the leader of the Intifada, Barghouti has emerged as a key figure during the last 15 months of uprising. He's a vocal opponent of the Israeli occupation and critic of the Palestinian Authority, a combination that has earned him widespread respect among Palestinians. Some believe if Arafat should fall or choose to step down, Barghouti would be the successor. Marwan Barghouti is a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council and leader of Fatah's military wing. He was interviewed by Free Speech Radio News reporter Raphael Kraft in early December. They met at an undisclosed location in the West Bank because Barghouti is in hiding from Israeli authorities. Over the summer, he narrowly escaped several assassination attempts by Israeli defense forces, and in early December, his house was stormed by Israeli soldiers. The raid came in apparent retaliation for an attack on a bus of Jewish settlers just days before. So now we go to Marwan Barghouti, Secretary General of Fatah, central figure in the Second Intifada, being interviewed by Raphael Kraft.
The bus attack on last Wednesday was maybe the start of a new era for the Palestinian resistance to concentrate its attacks into the occupied territories. It has been interpreted by Israeli as an attack inside Israel, which is a negation of occupation. Will the resistance keep on going this way, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad?
Yeah, from the first day, our strategy in Fatah and the Tanzim to concentrate our struggle in the occupied territories. And we call everybody to prevent any kind of attacks inside Israel. We do believe it's preferable to continue the struggle in the occupied territories and to targeting the Israeli occupation, including the settlers. I think this is the strategy. And I hope that Hamas and Islamic Jihad and all the groups will concentrate their struggle against the occupation here. But when the Israelis are continue in their massacres, assassinations, destroying the Palestinian headquarters, and etc., I think this was the result of that lead Hamas and the others to attack the Israelis inside Israel.
So you believe that in the near future Hamas and Islamic Jihad are going to strike again inside Israel?
No, I hope they will not do that. I hope that they will concentrate the struggle and the attacks against the Israeli occupation inside the Kuwait territories. But I think it's very difficult to keep this strategy when the Israelis are continue to bombing the Palestinian cities under the Palestinian Authority control, because the Israelis should respect our areas. And if they are enter in everywhere, bomb everywhere, killing the civilians, children, women, and etc., I think this will lead for more Palestinian reactions. And when this criminal prime minister in Israel, Sharon, when he decided to assassinate or liquidate any leader, he decided how many Israelis will be killed in the same time.
Since the start of the Intifada, the Palestinian resistance has shown a sort of policy of restraint in its fight during the Bethlehem occupation by not using heavier weapon like RPG-7. Do you believe that it is time for the Palestinian resistance to go forward and escalate?
You know that we should not go to fight the Israelis in their power points. We should prevent their power. And we should always find a way how to fight them, how to defeat them in another places. And I think this is, should be the main strategy for the Palestinian people. And I think that always the resistance will continue. If there is an occupation, it will continue. Never they can achieve security by tanks, by force, by assassinations, by closure, by these things. So I do believe that the resistance will continue. The Palestinians are patient enough, and they know very well that this is long fighting. It's not for 1 month or 2 months or 1 year or 2 years. It will take long time, so they should be patient and keep their power.
What is the state of the relationship between Fatah, DFLP, and the Islamic Jihad and Hamas on the field?
Yeah, we are working together, and we have coordination and cooperation in the political fields, in the activities of the Intifada. There is no any kind of coordination in military activities. Some cases, individual cases, relations or coordination in some places, in all over the West Bank and Gaza. But in central level, there is no any kind of this coordination in military activities, because it's very difficult. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. It's impossible for anybody to do that.
This new tactic Israel is putting forward by doing lightning incursions, arresting people, killing people in arms, does it weaken? How? In which way does it weaken the resistance? In which way are you? Is the resistance touched by that?
It has its effect on the people and on the Palestinian people, on the Palestinian Intifada and the resistance, and on the Palestinians general. You know that during every day, every night, the Israelis bombs by aircrafts, by Apache, by tanks, and they arrest a lot of people, killing, assassinations, demolish houses, cut, uprooting trees, and the closure, and etc. And the tanks are not far more than 200 meters from Mr. Arafat's office, and they are trying to pressure. But I do believe that this will not break the Palestinian Intifada or Palestinian resistance. The resistance will continue, and the Israelis, by this way, criminal way, they will lead the Palestinians for strong and more reactions against the Israelis. We are trying to give chance for the international efforts to be succeeded, to stop this comprehensive war. But all the international and European, regional, Arabs' efforts to stop Sharon war failed till now.
The attack on the bus killed settlers. They are illegal here in the occupied territories, but still they are civilians, and international law forbids the killing of civilians.
They are not civilians. The settlers are not civilians. They are part of the Israeli occupation. They are armed people. Their existence here is illegal. This is the point. Not why you are fighting against them. The question, why are they here? Why they confiscate the land and build their settlements by force, by tanks, by weapons, by killing the people? So I think it's to targeting the settlers, it's legitimate. And I think who are responsible of these victims, between if they are women or children, are the criminal Sharon. And these people should be in Tel Aviv, in Israel. Why they are here? What they are doing here? They are occupation.
You know that the mediatic war is much more favorable to Israel, and the bus attack of Wednesday night has been announced by all the media as like an attack against civilian in Israel. I know it's not. But taking this in consideration, don't you believe that targets should be focused on Israeli soldiers?
No. I think everything is legitimate against the Israelis in every centimeter in the occupied territories, in 67 borders. It has to be very clear. All the Israelis are legal targets in the occupied territories. All the Israelis, because they are not hostess. They are not coming as hostess or for the Palestinians. They are not invited. They are coming by tanks, as settlers, as criminals, and their existence here illegal, and we have the right to fight against the occupation, including the settlers. The settlers are armed people. All of them are armed people. And a lot of Palestinians were killed by the Israeli settlers. And you cannot distinguish between the Israeli soldiers and the settlers. They are the same. They are in the same settlement. It became like military camps and etc. And the soldiers are living there. In a day they are working, and at night they are working as soldiers and etc. And I think, of course, we don't like to see any children, any women to be killed, any people. And I would like to reach for peace without any killing, without this fighting, without these victims, without the bloodshed from the two sides. And we worked well during 7 years ago to enhance, to encourage the peace between the two sides. I was one of the prominent people who lead the Palestinian groups for dialogue with the Israelis, intellectuals, professors, academics, members of Knesset, and parliamentarians, politicians, everybody. We were trying. But what happened during 7 years? They toyed the Palestinians, they blamed of the Palestinians, they loved the Palestinian people, they doubled the number of the settlement, Judea and Jerusalem, keeping with our presence. They did every these. And it should be very, 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 very clear. The Israeli occupation are terror acts. This is the top of the terrorism in the world. There is no terrorism more than the occupation.
What do you think about Mr. Yasser Arafat's reaction condemning the bus attack last Wednesday?
I can understand the position of Mr. Arafat, and I don't accept. I think it's legal to attack all the Israelis here in the West Bank and Gaza, including East Jerusalem. And I hope that everybody will prevent any attacks inside Israel, because the borders of the Palestinian state, it's the 67 borders. And if the Israeli killing everybody in Ramallah, in everywhere, why should we respect them?
Well, do you, how would I say, what is your relationship today with Mr. Arafat? The resistance in the West Bank is quite weak at the moment.
Good relation, and I met with him every night, every day. And I think we should support him and his decisions to help him. The situation are very critical, and we are in very critical time in these days. They are trying to kill him. They are trying to destroy him. By political destroying, not and his authority and etc. So we call all the Palestinian political factions to give support for Musharraf.
Don't you think that this game Yasser Arafat has been playing or being forced to play in between the international public opinion, in between the Israeli public opinion and the Palestinian public opinion by condemning such attacks has weakened the resistance?
I think it has its effect, of course, but we can understand how much the situation is very critical. And we know how much the situation is very difficult, but I do believe we will pass these difficulties like what did during 15 months, and the Israeli will discover that they are, by these massacres, doing in Salfit, in Beit Hanun, in everywhere in the West Bank and Gaza, they will pay high price for their crimes.
And you've been listening to Marwan Barghouti, Secretary General of Fatah, central figure in the Second Intifada. He was interviewed by Free Speech Radio News correspondent Raphael Kraft, who reports from the occupied territories. He was interviewed in hiding in the occupied territories, an undisclosed location in the West Bank, because Barghouti narrowly escaped several assassination attempts, and in early December his house was stormed by Israeli soldiers. That does it for today's program. Go to our website at democracynow.org to get all the latest information and contacts and find out about the War and Peace Report. And Jackie Suin is our webmeister. That's www.democracynow.org. And at the end of the year, think about your community radio station and giving that last-minute gift as a charitable contribution at this end of the tax year. You can also think about giving it to us at Democracy Now, an additional gift. You can get information on our website, or you can send it to us at Democracy Now, P.O. Box 693, New York, New York, 10013. That's P.O. Box 693, New York, New York, 10013. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. We are still looking for some laptop computers, particularly Macintoshes, gifts to keep the Democracy Now! Team going and communicating and getting you the latest information. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by the intrepid Lizzie Ratner, Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We also have help from Matt Powers. Our team, video team, is incomparable with Molly Fink-Schneider and Orlando Richards. Also in the studio, Noel Rabinowitz, A War Cry, Didi Halleck, Skip Blumberg, as well as a number of other friends and family. Democracy Now! In Exile is broadcasting in exile from WBAI's Embattled Studios, the studios of the Band and the Fired, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
What is due unto I and I? You better give it on to I. There ain't gonna be no peace till man get equal rights and justice.
Special thanks to Rachel Jones.
And justice.